Hello, hello. You are very welcome to the first ever Love the Bees podcast. I'm your host, Yvonne Johnston, and this is your official excuse to start getting ready about the upcoming bee season. We're going to have a chat with a friend of ours. She's a beekeeper and she is a horticulturist, Adrienne Kelly. And she's going to talk about what she is doing in her garden. What I love about Adrienne is she does it with a beekeeping hat on. So she really is a wealth of knowledge on how we can increase biodiversity in our back garden. And we're going to have a really detailed chat about the humble dandelion, a flower we all know that the pollinators really need and adore. AFT really is a safe space for bee nerds. My friends and family are totally sick of me talking about bees at this stage. So this is really just an excuse for us to get together and talk about what we love most, our bees and our apiaries. We're going to have a chat with two very experienced beekeepers, both from Wicklow, Colin Penston and Dermot Fanning, to find out what they're at in their apiaries this month and what they are and aren't doing with their bees. And this is really to provide a to-do list for beginners, but if you're a seasoned pro, that's fine. It can act as food for thought or something you can argue about. We know when we're out in our garden and at our apiaries, we'll be hearing the birds chirping in the trees. So we have another expert for you, the birdman, Eric Dempsey, is going to give us a few tips on how to distinguish between the different bird song we might be hearing. Please follow us on Instagram at lovethebees.ie, or you can email me lovethebeesinfo@gmail.com. And really what we'd love is for our listeners to give us some feedback on what bits you did like, what you didn't like. And if you've any queries that you want our experts to address next month, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And finally, Love the Bees is supported by Donegal Bees. Without them, we would not have the wonderful Caitlin Kelly on our team as sound engineer. So big thanks for them for their assistance and to Caitlin for making us all sound pretty coherent. So let's go over to our gardening corner now with Adrienne. She is our horticulturist. And like I said earlier, she is a beekeeper. So approaches the garden with a beekeeping in mind at all times. I mean, if you're a bit like me and go out to the garden, particularly this time of year, and you don't really know what to be doing, Adrienne is going to set us straight. So what are you, I don't know, let's start with pruning. What are you pruning at the moment? What are we allowed prunes, say?
So I'm pruning all my hedges at the moment. So I have a lot of hedging in my garden. I have beech, which is really valuable because the aphids love beech. And especially late summer, you'll see a lot of bees and hoverflies and honeybees on the beech hedging because they're foraging for the honeydew that has been deposited by aphids because aphids love beech. So I tend to give it a good prune so that there's young, strong, healthy growth. I do it at this time of the year, and I sometimes have to do it because growth is so strong in my garden in August as well, towards the end of August.
And it's okay to go at pruning when it's just the outside, if it's the season for the birds to be nesting. Like, are we supposed to stop doing that after February, or is that just
heavy? We are. No, we're coming to the end of the season. Now, in gardens where they're in city gardens and where visibility onto the road is important, it is allowed at any time of the year. There are no restrictions, but you do need to be mindful of the birds and the wildlife. So I would, you know, you need to do it in a timely manner so that you don't end up impacting them later on in the year when you realize you can't see what's coming up the road. So I try and keep on top of it in the permitted times. But the birds, everything is early this year. And one of the things that we've also noticed, because my pruning is finished now for the season, because sap has started rising very early this year. And even some of the acers and what have you that I pruned in the past week or so, you know, there is sap dripping from them, which means they're taking longer to heal and they're bleeding. There's no problem at the minute because there's so much moisture in the soil. It's just coming into the plant and going out again whilst it heals. And it's been nice and dry, so they've healed over relatively quickly. But birch in particular takes a lot longer to stop bleeding. So, you know, I'm finishing my pruning now for the year.
If you've anything left to do, do it quick, being mindful of the birds.
Yeah. Now, there are some lovely plants flowering at the moment. You know, your viburnums are flowering at the moment.
Yeah.
Witch hazels and what have you. Forsythia will be coming along shortly. So any of the spring flowering shrubs, you can't prune them in the kind of season when the birds aren't nesting. You have to prune them after they've flowered. Otherwise, okay, you just end up chopping off all the flower buds. So there are a few judicious ones, spring flowering ones, that you will be flowering, pruning a little bit later after they've finished flowering. Then you can give them a good cut back. But do be mindful of wildlife and keep an eye out that you're not disturbing any nests. I mean, you know, you could leave it till later on after they've fledged to prune those.
Okay. And is there any point in planting anything at this stage?
You can still get all the bare root plants in the nurseries. They'll be available probably until the end of March.
That's up to Paddy's Day, isn't it? Or allowed?
Yeah. And all the bare rooted plants, they're very good value for a start.
Yeah.
And I do a lot of cuttings at the moment as well of the likes of hazel, nice strong young stems, and coming up towards the end of the month, I do my hydrangeas if I'm doing cuttings from them,
yeah,
and willow. And you can just put them straight into the ground. Not the hydrangeas, I do put them in pots, but the willow and the hazel can go straight in the ground and they'll root by autumn. We'll have good strong plants by autumn. And they're fantastic for the pollinators. They're all flowering at the moment, and the pollinators, the honeybees, even this weekend, were all over the willow in the garden.
Okay. Yeah, I saw they were all out on anything that they could get their hands on, really, or their antenna into.
And actually, that's another point. The willow, my willow, it's very open, so there wouldn't be anything nesting in it. I do leave the buds finish for pollen for the pollinators before I cut the willow back. So I do wait until the honeys and the bumbles are all finished harvesting pollen from the willow before I cut them back, and then I cut them back hard.
The other question I have, the verbena, you know, the tall fellas with the purple flowers that all the pollinators seem to love.
Yeah.
I left them till now, so they still have last year's flower on, and I was leaving them in it. Can I cut that right down to the bottom?
Cut all that dead material back. There won't be any seeds left. The birds will have polished them off. And
should I have done it before now then?
No, because you'll find that even though the seeds are gone, the seed heads would have provided shelter for a lot of the little insects like ladybirds, which are great predators of greenfly, and a kind of overwintering little house for the likes of, you know, earwigs and all sorts of little creatures live in those seed heads. So
go with them as well. So I can still get my bare roots in. I can cut back where possible.
Yeah.
And then is there anything else that we need to do before it warms up at the end of the month?
You can start doing your garden tidy up. I tend to leave I tie string around some of the taller perennials and I'm cutting them back, and I pull it in tight to make like little sheaves like you would with straw.
Yeah.
Cut it at the base then, and then leave it lying down on the ground. In little piles, if your garden is big enough to accommodate it. I mean, some people just have to clear it all away, but it gives the little overwintering bugs and insects that are valuable in your garden time to relocate and get used to the warming climate and what have you. And then you can put it in a little stack out of the way somewhere ready to go for composting. Generally, a lot of that stuff is kind of woody material. It's high in lignin. So I shred it to break it up more. And when you shred it, it breaks down faster because you're exposing more of a surface area of cut surfaces for the fungi and the bacteria that break down woody material to get to work.
I would never think to shred that. Okay.
It's lovely because once it's shredded, then you can layer it with your grass cuttings and your green waste. And it makes a lovely crumbly compost at the end of the season when it's all broken down.
And we were chatting earlier on, and you said that you're more southern than we are, and that you have dandelions out already. Is that the case?
I've had dandelions out for about 3 weeks now.
And I was actually thinking earlier, you know, before I was a beekeeper, I think I was probably indifferent to the dandelion. Yes, I knew that they were good for pollinators. But now that I'm a beekeeper and I get it, they just bring me so much joy when you look out and you see them. Do you think they are, I don't know, under attack from the eager mower these days? Like, I don't feel like they're as plentiful as they were when we were kid, when I was a kid.
I suppose we're all, you know, a lot of people are very busy and they use a lot of chemicals nowadays as their weeding mechanism. And, you know, the likes of Roundup and that will kill off your dandelions quite quickly and it'll keep the ground bare. If you're out in the country like I am, you'll find that dandelion clocks are blowing around from all over the place, out in the fields and everything. So we'd always have a plentiful supply. The roots of dandelions are brilliant for mining down deep into the soil and bringing up, you know, nutrients like phosphorus and, you know, potassium from deep in the soil that then, you know, if you pull up those weeds when you are weeding, you can leave them dry out and then you can grind them up and spread them on the soil and that nutrient will go back into the soil as a bioavailable organic fertilizer for your other plants. So I tend to dry them out to kingdom come. I put them on a bit of black plastic, let them get nice and dry. I mean, it's the same as dehydrating them if you're going to make dandelion tea from the roots.
So are you doing that while you're mowing or are you?
No, when I'm weeding separately.
In the beds.
When I'm mowing, in the areas where dandelions appear, they have a great self-defense mechanism. They have a lovely flat basal rosette, which is their leaves, on the ground. All you're doing when you mow is decapitating the heads off the dandelions. And that's fine because, as I think I've mentioned it to you before, a plant's imperative is to procreate. So they're going to put up more flowers. It's like deadheading a perennial to get a second flush of flowers. And they are perennials. So you mow them. Same with the daisies. The lawnmower doesn't do the plant, the entire plant itself, any harm at all. It puts up another lovely, fresh, new flower that the pollinators can avail of new, fresh nectar from and pollen from, which is fantastic for the wildlife. And you can keep that going all summer. I mean, most gardeners who like to mow their lawn will tell you, I only mowed the garden last night and the next day there's daisies after popping up again or another couple of dandelions.
That was a misconception I had. I thought, like, you know, don't mow them, but we're safe to mow them as long as it's not too low and they'll just come back up and it does some good if anything.
Like, I mean, when you mow plants, you know, you are removing some of the nutrients, you're taking it away. But in a healthy ecosystem, in a healthy garden, there's plenty of nutrients going around in the soil that will replenish the plant. One of the things I noticed last year was with No Mow May, some of the strips of, I suppose, ground owned by the council, by roadways and what have you, they were leaving them grow because of the dandelions for the pollinators, which was fantastic, but they never mowed them because of No Mow May. Yeah. One of the problems with that last year was we had a very, very wet year.
Yeah.
Now, they did get pollinated because there was a lot of dandelion clocks, but not necessarily by honeybees, for example, who weren't able to move about as much in the rain. Yeah. A lot of other pollinators can get around more easily than honeybees. The more adapted or suited to the wetter conditions. But it is a very important crop for honeybees.
And that's what I was going to ask you. Like, yeah. Is it that they're plentiful? Is it that they're early? Or is it that they're particularly nutritious? What is it about the dandelion that's so important?
Well, honeybees are quite picky and they have high value crops that they forage dedicatedly, of which dandelion is one. I suspect there's probably a selection of medicinal compounds in dandelions that really benefit bees, because early in the season, a lot of honeybees have Nosema, which is a little organism in their gut that can give them the runs and what have you. But towards by the time the dandelion season is over, a lot of them have purged that from their system. And it's really, dandelions are very good for human digestive system. So, you know, just extrapolating from that, it stands to reason that it benefits a honeybee's digestive system as well. And if they're foraged, if they're self-medicating on it as a crop, then it makes sense why they so dedicatedly forage on dandelion and bring in that pollen to their brood as well.
And does it provide both nectar and pollen?
It does, yeah, it does. And not just to honeybees, to all the pollinators. It's a very, very valuable crop to all of them. But if you mow it before it gets to the clock stage, you'll get a second flush of flowers. So that if the weather has been really inclement and a lot of the insects haven't been able to get out to it, then you're giving them a second run at it.
Okay, you so let's just give me that again. So if it's been mild, we should get out and give it a mow nice and early.
Leave it flower. Leave it have its first flush of flowers. If, like last year, it was very wet through dandelion season, through the first phase of the dandelion crop, so that a lot of pollinators couldn't get to it in certain parts of the country, then when it starts to go to seed, you can give it a mow. And that'll
have it ready for them before when
stimulate. Stimulate a second flush of flowers so that you might be able to avail of drier conditions that will benefit the pollinators and they can all get at it. And you know it's about to, you know that it's been pollinated when you see the flower go into a little peak with a little tuft of white at the top. That's the start of the clock formation, if you like, where you get the little achenes with the pappus with the little parachute on the seed. And if you mow it before that seed is released, then the flower will be very happily producing more flowers for you. The plant will produce more flowers.
Okay. Well, anyone who didn't know everything that needs to be known about dandelion now does. So we will have many a dandelion crop in all of our gardens this year, I think.
Well, hopefully. And there's so much more that we need to learn about them. They're fantastic crops. Yeah. They're a fantastic plant. And, you know, if you can embrace their sunny little faces and not be too diligent about your weeding, you can keep on top of them and stop them spreading like wildfire by just pulling off the seed heads before they have a chance to go floating all over the place.
Brilliant. Listen, thanks a million. And we'll talk to you next month. Right, let's get straight into it. I want to ask you first, what does the changeable weather we've been having mean for the bees, for the beekeeper, I suppose? Do we need to change or do more for March and April? I went out to the bees on Christmas Day and it was 14 degrees. And not only were they flying, they were bringing in pollen. We have a lot of gorse here, so they were bringing that in. And then we had our cold snaps and we had many a storm. Do we have to change our behavior? Do we have to do anything different, Dermot?
Yeah, it's been some weather, all right. As you say, 14 degrees at Christmas and then storms and then rain. You know, I suppose we haven't had bad weather, really. It's been very, very mild. Do we need to change anything? Probably not. The bees have probably adapted to this over thousands of years. So.
And do you think the native Irish honeybee, which, you know, we all have and are big champions of, do you think they cope better?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that our bees, well, obviously our bees have adapted to the climate here and are unique to Ireland as well. I think with 7 different DNA traits, but they certainly do adapt and they eat much, much less over the winter than other bees, than, you know, maybe more the continental bees. I think definitely native Irish bees definitely do far better and they're far more frugal with their food, you know, and they have evolved obviously to suit our damp, wet climate.
And if the bees are bringing in pollen like that this time of the year, if we're out there having a look, what does that mean?
Yeah, it means they're raising brood. It's always great to see it. You know, it's very exciting. You see pollen coming in, you know your colony's right. You know they're raising brood. You know they're lining up for springtime.
So you think my bees had brood at Christmas?
I would say definitely if they're bringing in pollen, they're raising brood. That's the protein for the brood. So yeah, it's always very encouraging to see pollen coming in. You know, then your colony's lining up nicely for the spring.
So what do we do as beekeepers at the moment? Should we be doing anything in particular?
Yeah, should be hefting your hives. Should, you know, all from Christmas on, really, you should be hefting your hives. See what you have. See, have they, you know, if they're heavy, fine. And if they're very light, like if they feel like they're going to blow away in the wind, then they need feeding. You have fondling really for the whole, from January on until probably early April.
And how often should I be feeding them fond?
You just keep an eye on them, really. You know, you'll lift your lid and see how your fondling is. You look in, you know, if we were checking bees last week, actually, and they had used 2.5 kilos of fondling, which is very encouraging. We know our colonies are strong then. And we actually had to give them 2.5 kilos more now, just that should do them. But again, if they use it, we would give them more. You know, they're expanding. The weather is milder. There's a lot happening in the colony now.
So you have a gazillion hives. Are you out every week then, or?
No, just check them once every, possibly every fortnight, just take a run around. You know, whichever apiary I'm close to, check and see how they're looking then. Obviously, if I notice in one apiary there's a lot of food being used, well, then it would, you know, it would trigger me to check the rest of them then. But right now, we are kind of coming up to that critical stage now where you have the change of bees and they will, the days are getting longer, the queens are laying more, they will get into greater demand for the food source. And like further on, maybe, you know, later in the month, it depends, different years, you'll have that critical change of bees.
What do you mean that critical change of bees?
That's where your old bees have survived the whole winter, probably for 4 or 6 months of winter. And then they're the ones who are now, you're reliant, the whole colony relies on them to raise the first batch of foraging bees. Like one worker bee can raise 3 new young bees.
So I can go from having, you know, 5,000 bees to what? And
you know, 5,000 bees can raise 3 times that. So they can raise 15,000 young bees. So that'll give you an idea of how much of demand. And those 15,000 young bees then will then raise another, go by 3 on that. So like, you know, if 40,000, but you would definitely have 25,000 or 30,000. And often you open a hive and you wonder what happens, an explosion of bees in this colony.
So, I mean, giving them pollen, are they bringing in pollen? What are they using at the moment?
Yeah, in Ireland, it would be a good pollen source. Like you generally, you know, you'll have the furze bush, you'll have the, you know, the hazel, the willow, you'll have a good, pretty good pollen supply, but you won't have the carbohydrates. You won't have a nectar flow really early in the year. It's most of those plants are pollen mostly, so you need to supplement that with food.
So if they've enough stores, do they still need to be supplemented, or?
No, good strong colonies, if there's good stores, you know, nukes are more susceptible to running out of food. Like I had a nuke there, and they 2 weeks ago I strapped them down the storm and they were heavy enough, and I hadn't given them fondant, and I went to check them here recently and it was just full of bees, but they had used up the 5-6 frames of storage and they had actually died out. You know, it was a mistake on my part. You know, I should have just had fondant on all the way along.
Okay, so I'm feeding them. I'm not opening the hive. I'm actually going to ask you, Colm, well, you know, we have a lot of excited beekeepers, me included, and we're out there looking at our bees, dying to get going. When can we actually open up our hives?
Great question, Yvonne. And it's a very important question because it pains me. Recently, you'd be looking at YouTube channels and stuff like that, and you have a lot of new beekeepers usually, and they're going into their hives in December and January, and I'm thinking, what are they going down into the brood chamber for? Because, I mean, if you find a problem, there's not really a lot you can do at that time of the year because there's no queens, there's no drones around to really rectifying. So just leave it alone. If the hive is bringing in pollen, you should be very happy because, as Dermot has already alluded to, it is a sign that the queen is laying. So what I was taught in my very first lecture in beekeepers beginner's course was from an old beekeeper. He never, ever would dream of opening a colony down into the brood chamber till after St. Patrick's Day. He uses St. Patrick's Day as his day, his gospel day, let's call it. And he only then would go in if the temperature is above 14 degrees. And basically what you're doing after Paddy's Day, if the temperature is above 14 degrees, you lift the lid off, crack the crown board, remove it, take out the first frame nearest to you, go straight into the middle of your brood chamber, take out 1 or 2 frames, take a photograph of them is probably the best way. Put them back in. Examine your photograph. If there's eggs and open brood in there, you happy days. Close it up. It's now time till middle of April before you would go in to do a full inspection.
Okay, so we've talked to Dermot about feeding them, hefting them. We're not opening them this side of Paddy's Day. We can open them then. What else? Let's take a beginner who might have two hives that have overwintered. We're assuming they've overwintered. They're out collecting pollen. They look healthy. What can we do to get ready in the apiary for them for post-April, well, post-Paddy's Day?
Well, Yvonne, that's a minus point to you because you should already have it already.
And I think that's why we're here, Colm, because I don't. I mean, I laugh because at Christmas we were exchanging messages saying Happy New Year. And like the response I got from Dermot was, as well as Happy New Year, are you ready? Are you ready for the season? And a long to-do list of what I should and shouldn't be doing. And, you know, that was kind of what prompted the idea of doing this, because I'm lucky I have Dermot and Colm in my life telling me what I should be doing. And there's a lot of beekeepers that are, let's go with busy, not lazy, and aren't necessarily ready just yet. So we're not obviously as good and organized as you pair. So tell us what we should be doing if we haven't already done it.
Well, the first thing I usually do is around February, I'll go out into my apiary, and if there's any foliage, as in trees or ditches near the hives that have grown over the season, I will trim them back, because now we're already too late. We're into March. Bird season has begun. So from the 1st of March in Ireland until the end of August, you're not allowed to cut ditches. So you're too late on that one, but you can still go in and clear off any grasses or anything under the hives. You don't want the foliage under the hives to be growing up and getting into the hives through the open mesh floors or anything. So trim off, tidy up your apiary, any trip hazards, anything like that, remove it from the apiary. Make sure your apiary is nice and safe for you to be going into now when you start your inspections, because when you are going in, you're excited and you burst in. But that's another little thing you should always do before you enter your apiary. Stop, pause, and think just before you get to your hives. Take a quick look, a visual inspection of the apiary before you go into the apiary is a very wise thing to do, because there could be something after falling from a tree or whatever, a trip hazard, simple little stuff. Just a quick visual observation. That's the first thing. But going back to equipment, right? So what you should have, just say you've two hives. My rule of thumb would be two hives. I need six supers for the season. So you need to have your six supers ready.
Six supers, is that not a bit optimistic now?
Well, not particularly. If you have two good colonies, which you might have, and there's forage in your area, well, then it is reasonable to think I might get three supers off each of these hives. But say you get two supers, you're still doing well, very well. And I mean, there are a lot of things dependent on that. You have weather, you have the condition of your hive, you have your apiary location. There are a lot of things dependent on how much honey you're going to get. So, I mean, it's a question a lot of the beginners ask, how much honey are you going to get? And my answer to them is, how good are you going to be as a beekeeper?
So we are going to be very good beekeepers, because we know what we need to do now. We need to be feeding them. We need to have the three supers ready to go. I assume we need nukes if we're doing splits, or talk to us about that.
Yeah, exactly. But I just revert back to what I said. So you'll have three supers for each hive. You need a couple of extra. So you have two hives. Say you have two hives. Well, then have 6 to 8 new frames ready to go into the brood chambers as well. This is the new way of doing it. You should change out at least three frames in your brood box every year. It's coming down from Scandinavia at the moment that they're completely changing out everything in the brood chamber. I don't subscribe to that, because the cost is just, if you have a lot of hives, is too much.
And what do I do with my old frames then, and my old wax?
Well, your old frame, you can use the old frame. Just take out the old, no, you'd have the new, you can reuse your old frame. But the wax, you cut out the wax, keep it in a bucket. The end of the season, all your wax can be melted down into a nice block and brought exchange back for wax in your beekeeping supplier in Donegal Bees.
So we can get our Donegal, we can get our fondant and our frames and our wax from Donegal Bees, but then we can also send back Bastard's wax.
Correct. There's an exchange program on it. I don't know the exact exchange rate at the moment, but for old wax that you have melted down, cleaned and rendered a bit and melted down, you can send it to Donegal Bees and they will give you an exchange rate on that. Or they're usually at most of the shows around the country anyway, and you can bring it to one of the shows and do it there.
Great. Okay. I think that's everything covered for this month. And before we finish off, I hear a big congratulations is in order for you, Colin. Big news for you.
What's that now?
New apiary.
Oh, yeah. I was very lucky to be come into a new apiary, let's say. I got the use of it, about an acre of land, and it's lovely. It couldn't have been positioned better, and it's very, very close to me, as in 4 minute drive from my house. So very lucky.
We might go through what you had to do to move your bees in next month.
Yeah, I only moved them last weekend. So yeah, we can go through that next time.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks guys.
I am winging it here with Eric Dempsey, who happens to be my next door neighbour, so didn't have to go far. He is the Birdman, well-known birder, author, moth enthusiast
of recent, yeah.
Photographer. Obviously, yeah. I have lots of prints of yours on my walls and they are stunning. So spring is upon us, the signs of growth, it's still a bit grey, but it's definitely happening. Is it my imagination or when I step outside, are there more birds singing, or is it just me being hopeful of brighter days coming?
No, you're right. There are more birds singing. It's firstly, it's not spring yet.
No.
Okay. Oh, in the world of birds, spring doesn't happen until at least March.
Okay.
It's still winter because we have still a lot of winter visitors around. But what we're noticing at the moment is a lot of our resident birds are beginning to form territories. And that's why birds are singing at this time of year.
So they've been there all winter long.
They've been there all winter long.
Quiet.
And it's sparked by just that extra bit of length of daylight.
Yeah.
And what is happening is they are beginning to just establish their territories. Now, they will sing mostly in the morning. They'll sing in the evening time. Because during the day, they still have to pack on a lot of calories during the day to keep them roosting safely at night.
I've noticed, yes, they're still absolutely, the food is evaporating on my feeder. It's like, I feel like I need to take out a second nose.
Yeah, if you're looking at the bird feeders, there's loads of finches, whatever. Yeah. But an awful lot of those finches are winter visitors from further north, maybe Scandinavia.
Okay, well, they're hungry finches.
They're hungry and they're calling a lot and they call to each other, but they're not singing. You'll notice a lot of the birds that are on your feeders may not necessarily be singing because they may well be heading back up to Scandinavia, and that's when they'll start singing, when they get up to their breeding ground. So it's the resident birds like robins and wrens and some of the coal tits. And at the moment, song thrushes and blackbirds are beginning to get into song.
That's what I was going to ask. So how do I know who I'm listening to?
It's a great challenge for people who don't know bird song. And what happens is people rush in and try to learn 50 bird songs all at once.
Yes.
So the key is one song at a time. Okay. And it's a perfect time of the year because there's not that many birds singing. In spring, when it gets a little later in May, you've all the warblers and everything coming in, and that causes mayhem when you're trying to listen to and learn some birds. So two birds.
I can focus on two.
Yeah.
So give
blackbird
it to me.
And song thrush. And both have very similar songs in the quality of the song. So a blackbird has a very rich song and they're fluty notes. They are strong notes. And blackbirds,
they turn your head.
Yes.
You hear it and then you go, who's that?
Yeah.
And you go look and you're like, yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. Absolutely incredible song. And the interesting thing about blackbirds is they tend to go to the highest point to sing.
Yeah.
You'll always see, I remember when I was growing up in Finglas, it was always on the TV aerials. The blackbird was at the highest point. So that's a really deep, rich, fluty song. Robins sing very similar, but it's a much weaker song, more sort of liquidy song. But so a big, deep song that is really strong and has great musical prowess, that's your blackbird.
And one thing, longer tunes than the other? I mean,
at this time of year, they are not in full flight.
Okay.
But the key difference between a blackbird and a song thrush, because the blackbird has that song, and the song thrush has a similar song, but repeats every phrase twice.
Yes. Yeah.
And that is the key. So with a black...
And you sometimes hear the thrush first and you think it's something else and then it'll literally just immediately repeat it.
And most of the phrases that a song thrush will sing are not the same phrase. Yeah. So with a song thrush, you might get something like...
Yeah.
And it's just a constant repeat of the song. Yeah. Whereas a blackbird... It has one fluid song that continues on. It isn't a repeated song.
And it's more of a melody.
It's a melody, yeah. and it's usually sang from very, very high on a tree.
Yeah.
Interestingly, song thrushes tend to sing from deep in cover. Mm. So you will often not see a song thrush, but you will hear them.
And is the rain a thing with the song thrushes? I feel like...
the song thrushes, but birds don't worry about the rain.
No, but I feel like they're always... out in the rain and they sing in the rain. Is that just my imagination?
It's just your imagination in many ways, but many birds will sing in the rain. Now, they won't sing for very long, but at this time of the year, the song thrush is really beginning to sing. And if there's a little touch of spring, if you get just a little feel that spring is in the air, you will often have blackbirds nesting very early. So it's all to do with the availability of food. So you can get blackbirds nesting in March.
So what when they're singing now then, they're just establishing their territory, but they haven't started.
They haven't started the whole mating thing because the birds sing for three reasons. Firstly, to establish their territory. This is my territory, keep out. Mm-hmm. Secondly, to
attract other song thrushes.
To other song thrushes and other blackbirds.
Okay.
And it's the males that sing. The females don't sing.
Okay.
So that's very important.
Yeah.
It's also attract a mate. Mm-hmm. So females can judge the quality of a territory and the quality of a male based on his song, the quality of that song. So if you
have a sports car is
yes,
is
in the, effect, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and later on then, when there's lots of birds nesting in spring, April, May, when they sing at nighttime and they sing at dawn, it's to say to other birds, I'm still here.
Okay.
Because they've established and they've done experiments that if you have a blackbird and you know, for us, a blackbird is a blackbird, but every blackbird in the whole area knows every other blackbird's particular song.
Okay.
And if one of those doesn't sing at night or at dawn, it means he's been taken. So you might have a neighboring blackbird saying, oh, that's a beautiful bit of territory over there. I'll carve into that and take that particular blackbird.
So every day they'll send off a reminder, morning and night, I'm still here.
Still here, back off.
And how big would their territory be? Is it a tree? Is it a bush? Is it a corner? Or is it a garden? Like robins or gardens?
Robins or a garden. But to be honest with you, it depends on the habitat.
Okay.
You know, if you have like a garden that is, you know, very rich, like you and I have a lovely wildlife garden. So one garden will provide enough food for a family of blackbirds. But if you were in a very sparse area or a built-up area, your blackbird might be dominating over 10 gardens.
They're in a terraced house. Gardens.
Yes, yeah. So it depends on the availability of food.
So if I see the same, you know, there's obviously favorite spots where they'll sing from. So if I see, there, you know, there's a branch where I'll often see a blackbird. Are you telling me that's the same blackbird I'm seeing?
Yes, then? Yes. And it's the male saying, this is my spot. This is my territory. I'm still here. And the other interesting thing is that calls and songs travel much better in cool air. So at night time, in the evening time, when they start singing, that song is crystal clear. It carries much further. So there's good time management when it comes to these birds singing. So just those two birds, if people can learn those two and then move on to another one. And we will talk about other birds over this podcast series.
The other thing I was going to ask you was, we know we can't cut back the hedgerows from the end of February. Is there anything else we can do to help them or at least not to hinder them?
Well,
their territories.
Well, the most important thing to me is keeping an area wild.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to song thrushes, slug pellets are a no-no
mm-hmm.
because they eat particularly snails. So unless you're going to go out every morning before dawn and collect up every dead and dying slug.
Okay.
And basically just keep areas wild, yeah, and no pesticides, yeah, no slug pellets. And, you know, cutting back hedges, because some birds like blackbirds can nest, you know, in March, please, once the end of February comes, yeah, just keep the hedgerows a little bit wild. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, look, we'll talk to you again next month. Thanks a million, Eric.
My pleasure.
Fun fact for the family. Did you know honeybees are big huggers? While other bees hibernate or go dormant, the honeybees give each other this big group hug, and one that lasts all winter long. So even in the winter, these tiny, incredible creatures are looking after each other. They spend the whole summer foraging and making enough honey so that they can feed off it in the winter. And then they just get into this big huddle, like the shape of a football, and they hug it out with the queen in the middle, making it lovely and warm from her. Then the females, the worker bees, vibrate their flight muscles and generate 20 degrees to stay nice and warm and protected. And then, because we're getting some nice mild days now, they might break away from that cluster to collect pollen or to have a toilet break. Yes, even in the winter, their hive remains absolutely spotless. But generally, they're going to stay in this cluster, a ball of cuddling bees, for the whole winter long. That's why we don't open them up, and we leave them until they emerge when the weather is nice and consistently warm. That's a wrap, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening in. We'd love to hear from you between now and next month, and do what you can to show the bees that you love them too. See you next month.